Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. Today we have a double dose of Anne Stringer. Not only did she write this one, she is also the narrator. This is another from our Amarant series. Before we get into the story, we want to remind you that March and April are big months for podcasters going to print. Not only can you purchase the next fix by our own Matt Wallace, but there is also Seth Harwood's Jack Wakes Up and Scott Sigler's Infected. It is an exciting time for all of them. Let's show support for these hardworking people. They are all great writers. Now, on to our story. Birth and Death by Anne Stringer. Birth rules the life of a midwife, but she has also seen plenty of death. When she realizes she is immortal, birth and death begin to look the same. She knows that any new baby she helps bring into the world will die, in time. But she learns to look beyond the specter of death when she sees the look of bliss on a new mother's face, and gains the wisdom to live in the moment.
"I don't envy you in the least," the woman on the bed says, and her smile erases the wrinkles on her cheeks for a moment. "I've lived a good long time. It's been a good life, but I'm tired now, and it's time to go." Her thin, bony hand squeezes mine. I don't squeeze back. With her arthritis, it would be too painful. "You can tell?" I ask. "Yes, of course." Her eyes close and she dozes. She is spending less and less time awake now. I don't know how much time she has, and I wonder if she does. By normal standards, she is very old, 105 years. She has outlived all of her children and some of her grandchildren. Those remaining are on their way to her bedside. But she has told me that she feels closer to me than to any of them, and so I am here. She knows my secret. She is the only one who does. Because of this, and because I love her so, I will be terribly sad to lose her. Though she is old, I am older by far. I attended her birth, and now I will witness her death. Birth and death. These things rule my life, though I will experience neither for myself, as far as I can tell. I am a midwife, and have seen both, sometimes at the same time. Childbirth could be a dangerous thing, especially in the days long past. If the infant was too large to pass, if the lie was wrong, if bleeding could not be stopped, then mother or baby or both would die. With all the things that can go wrong, I find myself amazed at times that any woman chooses to undergo it. Of course, back then, they had no choice in the matter. I began as most of us did, as apprentice to an experienced midwife. In my case, I learned at my mother's side. Father died of some stomach ailment when I was very young, and her skills kept us fed and sheltered. They also kept us on the move. Women on their own have always been in danger, it seems, from one source or another. Danger never should have come from village elders or clergy, though, but it did. If they could not control us, they persecuted us. Back then, nearly any excuse served to accuse a person of witchcraft. It was almost always women. If she was too smart, too stupid, too sick, too healthy, she was a witch. Midwives were at risk because we understood mysteries of a woman's body, of birth and death. I remember the witch trials because I was there. And so anytime the word was spoken, we would pack up and go, often in the dead of night, often leaving behind women who needed us. Mother felt badly about that, but she had seen too much to take a chance. The first one I saw was a 13-year-old girl. She had come to fetch us when her mother's labor pains began. She was a simple girl, but could handle tasks like that. Fetch some water, bring me that pot, go get the midwife. But on the way back, she stopped suddenly, staring straight ahead. I had seen her do this before, but it was always inside their house, where there was no one around to see but her mother. This time she was out in the open, and there were people around. I took her arm and hurried her along, though her steps were stiff and she stumbled. A boy from the village was watching wide-eyed. Mother and I shared a worried look. The boy ran off, and we ushered the girl into her house. I remember that labor was a difficult one. The mother was nearly hysterical with pain, and she lost a great deal of blood. At last, the babe emerged, a boy, but he looked thin and wasted, and he had a clubbed foot. He breathed, but it seemed an effort for him, and did not bring the pink glow of health to his skin. Worried for him and for his mother, we stayed with them throughout the night. She gradually became better, but the infant declined, and he died in his mother's arms before morning. My mother was horrified. We tried to console the woman as she wept over her son's lifeless body, but my mother kept casting worried glances at the girl who'd had the fit. She slept on a pallet in the corner, oblivious. Trouble came with the sunrise. The woman's husband came into the birth room with an elder of the village. They looked at the child, then at the girl, who went into another fit at the worst possible moment. Her mother pleaded with them, and so did my mother. "She's not possessed," they said. "She's no witch. She's simply ill, not right in the head." But they were convinced that the boy's misfortune was caused by his older sister, and they dragged her, crying for her mama, away. My mother took my arm, pulled me close, and whispered that we must go. I had never seen such fear in her eyes before that moment. We assured ourselves that the woman would be all right, and we hurried back to our cottage to gather our things. But before we could leave, the men came for me. As it turned out, only as a witness, since I'd been close to her when the fit happened. I tried to tell them the girl was sick, nothing more, but they paid no attention. They were interested only in what I saw, not in what I thought. They decided she must be a witch and warned me that if I defended her, I could face the same fate. I watched in horror as they bound her to a stake and piled wood at her feet. She seemed merely confused by the proceedings, looking around the gathered crowd for her mother. When the faggots were lit, I could no longer look, but nothing could block the sound of her increasingly desperate cries of, "Mama! Mama!" until the thick smoke choked them off. I was able to slip away when the crowd began to disperse. I ran all the way home to find Mother ready to leave. We walked for days, our belongings on our backs, until we found another village in need of a midwife. And so our lives went until my mother was too old to work. We had some lean years then, as I did the birthings and cared for her as well. Though she must have noticed that my appearance hadn't changed since my mid-20s, she never mentioned it. She never told me I should have wed and had children of my own, because she knew as well as I that these things were hazardous for women. She only told me that she loved me and that she was glad I was with her at the end, wished me well, and was gone. I have been on my own since and continued to live the life of a wanderer. It had become clear to me that I had more to fear than ever before. If a girl who merely had fits was burned as a witch, what would happen to a woman who never aged? And so I never stayed in any one place too long. It wasn't always easy to move on. There were places and people I came to love that I mourned leaving. Quiet places with warm and honest people, far from fear and danger, but even there I could not linger. I was unchanged for too long, so in time I would give them some story and move on, or tell them nothing and steal away in the night. It amused me to come back to some of my favorite places after enough years had passed so that no one knew who I was. Often the village was unchanged and just as welcoming as it had been before. I could see familiar features in the descendants of people I had known, an odd eye color here, bright red hair there. But other times, places had changed, and not for the better. They had grown, become impersonal, had beggars in the streets. Or they had come under the control of a tyrant. I was sometimes amazed at how many aspects of daily life those types wanted power over, including childbirth. Naturally, they knew nothing about it, but the Bible said that labor must hurt, so I was forbidden any attempt at relieving pain, for example. I didn't stay long in places like that, though it broke my heart to leave those women behind. Then there came a time when I tired of it. One birth was much like the next, and they blended into an endless parade of blood, sweat, and pain. Each new child would grow and live the same dreary life as her mother or his father, and they would produce children who would continue the cycle. Those who were fortunate enough to survive childbirth would grow old and die anyway. It began to seem pointless when I could look into the eyes of a newborn and see death. Once again, I moved on. I expanded my skills as a healer and cared for the injured and the ill, as well as women in labor. I traveled with armies and set fractures, bound wounds, even amputated limbs damaged beyond repair. Aid and comfort were always welcome. Eventually, though, this seemed even more pointless than birth, the wounds that humans inflict upon each other. My first calling had always been childbirth. Women were always having babies. I was always needed. I learned to look beyond the specter of death and see the joy in the face of a new mother cradling her infant to her breast for the first time. Her life might have been hard, but at that moment she knew bliss. That was the wisdom she gave me, to live in the moment. That simple lesson has saved me from despair over the long years of my life. It gave me the courage to keep moving, to try new things. I traveled on a ship to the New World. It astonishes me now that there were pregnant women on that voyage. "One does as one must," one of them said to me as she rested between contractions. She was a hardy type, to give birth without a whimper as the ship rolled on waves beneath us. But there was no privacy on that boat, and she had no wish to frighten other passengers, as she told me after, as her robust daughter took her first milk. Death sailed with us as well. A young man became ill and was unable to take even water. Near the end, he was burning with fever, and fear grew of a plague overtaking the passengers and crew. In the end, though, his was the only body given to the waves. It was an enormous relief when land was finally spotted. After so long at sea, dry land felt wonderfully solid. Even I felt the excitement of a place so new and wild. None of us knew then just how vast a land it was. I spent lifetimes discovering just that, moving on from relative civilization of the colonies to the expanse beyond. I had never felt quite so alive as I did then, living off the land, isolated, serving no one but myself. It was not to last. In the dead of winter, a man found my lonely cabin. His wife was laboring, and it wasn't going well. Could I please help? It seemed civilization had found me. There was a small settlement in the next valley, and the woman labored in a single-room cabin. She was a tiny thing, and I could see her belly heave and strain with the effort of expelling the child within. A steady trickle of blood flowed from her. Her skin was pale, and beads of sweat stood on her face. Pain and desperation showed in her expression. I touched her, felt the baby's lie. It was wrong, all wrong. The child was too large to pass, I was certain. Still, I had to try. But the baby would not turn. There simply wasn't room. I took her hands in mine and told her, as gently as I could, and that I would give her medicine to make her as comfortable as possible. "Save my baby," she begged. I knew what she meant. Her husband was almost as pale as she was, but he nodded at me. I fed her laudanum, and then he handed me a knife. I took a deep breath and cut into her swollen belly. She gasped, but lacked the strength to cry out. I knew this had been done before, but never by me. I worked quickly, slicing through layer after layer, finally reaching the womb and then its contents. The sac released bloody fluid, and then I was able to reach the child, a boy. He was limp and frightfully blue, but let out a weak cry when I rubbed him dry with cloths. The new mother's face had no color at all now. I wrapped the babe and tucked him into her arms. She smiled faintly. Her belly was a mess, the task of putting it back together daunting, but the attempt had to be made. Her life left her before I could even begin. Her husband held their son and wept openly. He talked to his dead wife, told her how sorry he was that he'd brought her so far from their home. He told her he would raise their son and that he would know how brave his mother had been. Calmer by then, he thanked me for saving the boy and assured me they'd be well. There were women in the settlement who would help. I'd seen death before, of course, but never felt so much that I'd caused it. I left and went back to my cabin, but now it seemed so empty. I realized then I was ready to rejoin society to serve again. A 105 years ago, I assisted in the birth of a child who was unlike any I'd ever seen in all those years. The birth itself was unremarkable, in that it progressed so normally, but the infant, a girl they named Sarah, was a surprise. Her eyes held a depth of wisdom impossible in one so young. She looked at me and she seemed to know everything about me. That seemed like fanciful imagination on my part, but I had learned long ago to rely on intuition. While continuing to take the precautions necessary to hide my secret, I maintained contact with her as she grew. She was still very young when she asked me what it was like to be so old. Now, I know that to a child, all grown-ups are frightfully old, but it seemed significant to me. I moved on, but came back when she had her babies, and we had long talks over tea. For the first time in my life, I knew someone I could trust completely. I could tell her anything. To an outsider, our conversations would have sounded insane. To us, they were perfectly natural. I cried with her when her second child was stillborn, celebrated with her when she had twins. I left when I needed to. More time had passed than I realized, and it brought technology with it. There was a great potential there for the practice of midwifery, for making childbirth safer, but at the same time, the tendency arose to remove nature from the process to its detriment. Doctors were taking control. Though they tried to remove midwives from practice, I found I was still needed. There were few doctors in remote areas. Childbirth had been much the same in all the years of my life. But now, with mixed feelings, I watched things change rapidly. On one hand, childbirth almost never requires the level of intervention that was being imposed. But on the other, it could have saved the tiny frontier woman and many others I'd seen. I was grateful to refer the riskiest cases on to obstetricians. Sarah's daughters had their babies in the hospital. Her granddaughters did, too. How strange it was that caring for a woman giving birth had changed more in Sarah's lifetime than it did in all the years I lived before that. Yet by then, a movement was afoot to return childbirth to a natural state. Some women even chose to give birth at home. I was as busy as ever, but I always had time for Sarah. It was a unique experience for me watching Sarah age. Of course, I'd seen people at all stages of life, but never had I seen the progression in one person. It was fascinating. "You're staring," she scolded gently the last time we had tea together. Now I hold her hand and watch her sleep. Her breathing has become erratic. Her doorbell rings and I slide my hand free of hers to go answer it. Her family is there. I recognize her features in all of them. "She's waiting for you," I tell them, and they head for her bedroom. One little girl hangs back, looking up at me solemnly. Her eyes hold a depth of wisdom impossible in one so young. "Will you come back?" she asks. I smile. "I will," I say.
The amaranth flower, sacred to the goddess Artemis, did not fade or wither, and so symbolized immortality. You have just heard Birth and Death, another tale of immortality, part of a collection by Anne Stringer and Matt Wallace. Listen for more stories of the amaranth in future episodes of Variant Frequencies. Thank you for listening to Birth and Death, written and narrated by Anne Stringer. I also would like to note that while much of our music in this episode came from Apple's GarageBand and from Digital Juice, the cello that you hear at the beginning and the end is written and performed by Christine Williams. Chris is the woman who taught cello to my son Neil for many years. Thank you, Chris. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like Variant Frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you. From the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Anne Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
They tap into your bloodstream like tiny little vampires. They hack into your nervous system like you were a walking computer network built just for them. They flood your body with chemicals that cause fear, paranoia, and psychotic rage. It's a disease that thinks. It's a disease that talks. And if you're lucky, you die before it becomes a disease that walks. On April Fool's Day, experience the horror thriller novel, Infected, the major hardcover release from number one bestselling author, Scott Sigler, creator of the free podcast novels, Earthcore, Ancestor, and Nocturnal. Available April 1st, online and in bookstores everywhere. Free audio chapters of Infected are available at scottsigler.com and infectednovel.com. The disease kills you slowly if the cure doesn't kill you first.
In the summer of 2006, Jack Wakes Up, the podcast, was born. In summer 2007, Seth Harwood brought you Jack Palms 2, This Is Life.
It's a cold world and this is life.
And now, in the spring of 2008, Jack Palms 3 and Jack Wakes Up, the print novel, both arrive to rock your world, not once, but two times. Nathan Kane of the Indie Crime Blog says, Jack Wakes Up is an action movie between two covers. And Scott Sigler, Evil Demon, says, Harwood sucker punches crime fiction. It's not a fair fight. Visit SethHarwood.com now to find the latest and greatest in crime fiction as Jack Palms 3 debuts Sunday, February 24th. And on March 16th, Palm Sunday, Jack Wakes Up hits Amazon.com with a vengeance that you have to be a part of to believe. This is your chance to send another shot across the bow of big publishing by telling them it's what you like that really counts. Listen to Jack Palms Crime now at SethHarwood.com, then buy it on March 16th, Palm Sunday, to help push Jack Wakes Up to the top of the Amazon charts. SethHarwood.com. Not just another free podcast, it's a way to tell the world what you really like.
Consider this promo a controlled substance. Only one drug can bring the visceral and the sublime together in a single trip. Where the best and the worst of the human drive boils down into a techno-noir concoction that's half street-level heaven and half the fiery beauty of hell. From Matt Wallace, Parsec award-winning author of The Failed Cities Monologues, this is The Next Fix. Kick back to the strains of Earth's Last Top 40 as the final human DJ sends a shout-out over The Last Frequency. Step into the hard-boiled beauty of the Lusting Corridor, where that which once escaped a man is met again. Tool up with a lone cop who polices the terrifying carrion underground of the future as you seek the end of flesh. Experience one of the most unique and captivating imaginations in fiction today, collected for the first time anywhere in print and featuring 12 original stories and one full-length novella, The Next Fix, by Matt Wallace.
Hi, this is Mer Lafferty from I Should Be Writing and Playing for Keeps and a bunch of other stuff. But I just wanted to say that Matt Wallace is big like Bear. He is smart like Bear. And he writes like Bear. Scary stories that roar at you and make you look for the closest tree to climb. Maybe if you roll over and play dead, the next fix won't bite. Maybe.
Matt Wallace serves up two-fisted literary action, if, of course, your fists are half-cybernetic, the size of ham hocks, and covered in broken glass.
Hey, everybody. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son podcast novel trilogy here. Matt Wallace is the boogeyman in your closet. He's the monster under your bed. He's the shadow that slides along the walls. Matt Wallace's writing is so compelling and so terrifying that you'll keep turning the pages, addicted to his work, questing for the next fix.
Pre-order your copy today in limited edition hardcover from ApexBookCompany.com and have it personally inscribed by the author himself. Are you ready for the next fix?
Okay, fantastic. You're doing great. Now push. And release. There you go. Okay, one more time.
You've got to be kidding.
This one more time. And push. And there you go. Mrs. Johnson, congratulations. You have a happy, healthy inner geek.
Aw, man.
Sponsored by Technorama, who reminds you to geek responsibly at chuckchat.com.